Thank you. I'm glad this thing is holding up now. I heard someone last night say if it doesn't stop swinging up and down, he's going up to his room and get that Viagra spray so it'll stay stiff for a while. Really, since I've heard that, I'm a young man in an old container. I'm 75 years old, and he told me there's a light on the end of the horizon, Viagra, so I'm going to listen for him. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad I'm here. I've been to Atlanta many times. I was at your old-time gratitude banquet not too long back. I don't remember months where I'm at. But, you know, I want to thank Tom and Bill and Charlie for inviting me down here. I want to thank the host, who I haven't seen yet, but I'll get to meet. And it's because he's working, you know, but I got to meet Jack. And, you know, Jack is a bigger size host. And he's doing a... So we sat up until 1:30 discussing the merits of the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I happened to come in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1961 and haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that time. And I think... I really believe that my reason for staying sober was because of good sponsorship, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Sister Ignatia, who I love very dearly. And not too long ago, I gave the eulogy at her mass because I spent 5 years with her. And when she come out of the when you left her hospital, she gave you a pamphlet, and I got to find it. I got it here someplace. It's kind of worn out now. It said confidence in God. But she gave you dignity long before you knew you had any dignity. Sister Ignatia dealt with dignity, self-respect, and the things of that magnitude we don't hear too much about anymore today. And she wrote, "Dear Mr. Cassini," now at that point I didn't think I was anything. And she said, August 31st, 1961, October 18th, 1961, that's the time I was in the hospital. May God love you and bless you and keep you forever close to the Sacred Heart, Sister Mary Ignatia. Please say a prayer for me. As we left the hospital, she gave us something to remember her by, which was a Sacred Heart. And she said, if you decide to drink, bring this Sacred Heart back before you do drink. This Sacred Heart has never been returned, because I believed what she said. I believed that long before I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and alcohol was never my problem. I've heard people from these podiums across the country, alcohol is their problem. Alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was my solution. I have never inventoried alcohol. If you have, I got to see your book, because I didn't read that book. And I told one of the girls here, start reading the black lines rather than the white, because they're easier on your eyes. And you know, we were taught the right from wrong, and I think I had character defects long before anything happened. You see, I was blessed because in 1960 they took that word honesty out of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it said you had to have become totally honest. And they made it sincere, and the sincere desire to quit drinking, and that's how the Italians got in. Now, we had never made it. And that's what happened. But you know, I had a lot of character defects. And at 17 years old, a war started. I think it was started December 7th. Some of you people don't know that was a big war. And it was 1941. And I had those character defects. I lived in a ghetto, which was all Italian. I didn't know that at that time, but I found out later. He spoke of the riots, and when the riots started and desegregation, we found out I lived in a ghetto because it was all Italian. And on the other side was all Irish, and the other side was all Polish, and the other side was Lake Erie. Whoever wound up there was the winner. And you know, and had environment had anything to do with my drinking, I would have been a gangster. I come close, but I would have been, see? Because environment had nothing to do with the way I lived. My father and mother were good people. I was born in 24, which told you that I was living through the big part of the country when it was on the high, and then I was there when the Depression came in. So I don't know what poor is because everybody was poor. So I don't have that excuse. I don't have an excuse that my father beat me, or he did do that. And you know, sometimes you'd hit me pretty hard. And he, thank God today he's not alive, but if he had that Civil Liberties Union where he could have turned them in, he'd have been in jail for a long time. And you know, I said, why do you beat me that hard? He said, because I love you. And I can understand that today. And I think maybe we should give back some of that love to some of these kids that they've been missing for so long. And I believe that from the bottom of my heart. When we started with spare the rod and spoil the child, it was wrong, see? And I think what happened, I had those character defects long before I knew I could get away with them. I didn't get away with too much. But you know, I had the character defects. I had, number one, I was Italian, and I was taught that Italians can do anything. I was always small, and I was taught by my cousins who were, they were bad people. They were part of a mafia, one of them. He said, if you're small like me, you got to be crazy. So in order to be small and crazy, you had to do things that were crazy. And I would do things that were crazy, and I thought I was tough, you know. But you know, everybody that thinks they're so tough, I want to tell you that today, you're operating out of fear. No matter how big you are, there's always some guy that's going to take you down. And fear motivates most of us. And I joined that army in 1942. I went to the army. And when I got there, I found out I made a grave mistake. I had more authority there than I ever wanted. So I'll take you to a very brilliant, star-studded army career without drinking. I had 15 summaries, two generals given a dishonorable discharge and sent to penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas. Without drinking yet, but one time. I drank one time. I was in a town called Fort Leonard, Missouri. I was at the camp there, and it was a city outside of that camp, maybe population 300. On a Friday night, the soldiers got their passes and it grew to maybe 10,000. And it was better known as Gonorrhea Gulch. So you would go there to find a woman, and you want to go to Joplin to go to a dance, because we were a country that danced at that time. I know today they don't dance no more. And I found this girl, and ironically enough, she was from Georgia. And she talked funny, and she thought I talked funny. So we knew one thing. I knew what I wanted, and I didn't know what she wanted, but I thought she understood. So we went to a dance in Joplin, Missouri. And when we got there, there was no liquor because the war was on. It was a package store town. Some of you may know what they were. You bought liquor in another room, and you come in a big room like this and bought setups and danced. So I said, what do you have to drink that makes this girl sexy? Since we have no whiskey. He said, I got old Mr. Boston Creamy Tops of gin. And he held up a bottle that looked like wine. I said, well, give me two bottles, because I knew my dad could drink one of those. Well, we danced differently than you kids do now. So we went there and we started to dance, and we had that gin, and we were sipping. And when we were dancing then, we held the girl close, and you knew what you had in your arms. You could feel them, you know what I mean? There was a body structure that changed different than ours. And you bend them down to the floor a little bit, and they'd hang on tighter. And then you knew you had a woman in your arms. And you know, we dance and dance and dance, and I start dipping and sipping on that gin. We were sipping and dipping, you know, just kept on sipping and dipping on that gin. And by 11:30, one bottle of gin is gone. She don't have the program, and I'm fully encompassed in this great program I got going. Nothing is happening, so you remember we have a computer. And something I may say tonight will stick in your computer, and it'll come out a year from now. Or something, the other speaker says something a year from now. You may hear it, and it'll come out a year from now when you need it. So I remember what old Clem Bone, he was the guy that taught you how to smoke cigarettes, talked to you about the girls at the dance hall. She talked about the girls that worked in the house of ill repute. He knew everything. He was our spiritual leader. And when we got there, I remember he'd say, when you're dancing, blow in her ear. So I was sip, dipping, and blowing, sip, dipping, and blowing. Next thing you know, I woke up in Joplin, Springfield, Missouri, and didn't know how I got there. No money. I was broke. And at that time, if you had to call the MPs to go back to camp, you paid for their ride. So I went back. I don't know what happened. Don't know what happened to that girl. Didn't see nothing of her. No more. So I went back to camp, and when we paid $21 a month. I know most of the people in America wouldn't fight for $21 a month in the Army. But we did it because we believed in America. Ironically enough, I still believe it's the best country in the world. But at that time, I was a little perturbed because I went to get that paycheck envelope with $21 in it. There was only $11. They had taken $10 out for an allowance. And I don't know why my mother would want to write for an allowance. And the guys, I went to the company commander and I asked him. He said, well, Cassini, he said, you screwed up that time. I said, what do you mean I screwed up? He said, well, the day we picked you up in Springfield, you were married that weekend. And I said, hold the fort. I never been married. He said, you have. Here's the papers to prove it. And I don't know who I married, what I married, if you and I had a honeymoon. And at that time, all you needed was a dog tag number. Some of you older people maybe remember World War II. All you needed was a dog tag number, and she had that number. She filled out a form at the draft board where, in that city, and you got money taken out of your check for her. So I went around talking to people, and you know, if I told you that today, you'd say I was nuts, you know what I mean? They thought I was nuts. My company commander laughed. My sergeant, he laughed. And I just didn't know where to go, so I finally went to a priest. And I told the priest, and he said, I'll look into it. You know, I hate to say this, but sort of, they sort of reminded me at that time of some of our delegates. If you ask them something, they say, we'll look into it. By the time you catch them around the next time, they say, I'm no longer a delegate. I'm out of office. So I don't have an answer. I went through that with our vice chairman of the Denton General Service. Anyhow, he came back 4 months later, and he found out this girl was a very patriotic American, and she married 4 or 5 guys that weekend. And she had all the checks going to the same house with a different last name with the same first name of her. And that's how she got caught. I imagine with computers today, she'd have never got caught, you know. But they were writing them out by hand that time. Anyhow, that ended that marriage. It was annulled. And I went on never more to drink again, but I got in some serious trouble. And I got in some serious trouble in the Army that caused me to go to the penitentiary. And this was because of an attitude of Italians, that I was Italian, I was tough, no one could screw around with me and get away with it. I had relatives who were members of an outfit called the Mafia. And for those who think that the Mafia doesn't exist, it does. Let me just tell you this, AA is like the Mafia. Because if you leave here, you're dead. More so today. And you know, it's the truth. Anyhow, I went to the penitentiary there, and I remember there was a bunch of guys there, and a lot of them were Italians. Evidently, they didn't like authority either. And one of them found out who my cousin was, and that his brother was there too. So I didn't find out his brother until a little later on, because we were in different parts of the prison. And when I did, it became a ride on a gravy train. You know, everybody knew that we were supposed to be let alone. So after 8 months, they came and asked who would like to join his armed special forces. And they said, if you come back, you get an honorable discharge. And he said, you're going to be advanced scouts. And if you're going to go, we'll give you special training. If I go over with a platoon, two decide to come back, a squad of men rather, two decide to come back. That's a miracle. If one comes back, it's par for the course. And of course, no one believes they're going to die. We're invincible. You know, you're young, you got nuts. So I put my hand up, and I see by the same time my cousin Mikey put up his hand too. I've seen him step forward from the end of the line there, and we both went from advanced training, and we went to learn to be advanced scouts. And you know, it wasn't easy, it was tough. You know, I'd like to tell you the war caused me to become an alcoholic, and it didn't. It didn't. My book says we stop blaming people, places, and things. And I may talk about this big book tonight because it's an important part of our sobriety. This is not fun and games. And I believe that. And you know, I didn't come in the easy way. Anyhow, we went overseas. We made 2 major land invasions. We went in first before the waves came. First waves would come in. And on the third one, we went in. We were about outside of a cave in the South Pacific. And my cousin Mikey was an arm's length away from me. We were walking in together almost. And he stepped on a landmine. He was blown to pieces, and I was blown up pretty bad. And the first word out of my mouth was, "Says God, did I get hurt bad enough to go home?" And the corps man heard me, and he said, "You're going home, kid." So I went to Hawaii for major surgery, and then from there back to the United States, and then to recuperate in Pasadena General Hospital. Now, when I got to Pasadena, I fell in love with California. I came from Cleveland, which is a smokestack industry town. Everybody complained about the smokestacks. Now we got no smokestacks. We got no employment either. So I don't know if there's a correlation between building factories working and people making money. And smoke, I'll take some smoke. But you know, I was there and I fell in love with the scenery. The buildings were different colors and the streets were clean. And I came from the smokestack industry. And I didn't want to go back. So I stayed around until I was discharged. After about 7 months, I learned to walk. And fell in love with it. And I, you know, where I came from, we only saw girls wore babushkas and galoshes, you know. And the only kind of music we ever heard was E-I-E-I-O music from Frankie Yankovic. So I fell in love with California, and I stayed. When I was discharged, I got some menial jobs. And eventually one day, my cousin came in, Bad Eye, came in from Cleveland with a bunch of Italians, and they were going to organize the studios. So they told me that I could be an organizer. When it was all done, I'd get a job. So I went as an organizer, and I stood at a gate and wouldn't let no one in. And no one came to my gate because my cousin Bad Eye made sure I was at the farthest gate. Even the fire department didn't know there was a gate there. That's how far he had me out. But when it was all over, we were offered jobs, and I went to the, I forget what it was called, the Roosevelt Hotel or something to help with that hotel. And we went there and they offered us jobs, and the guy said to me, what would you like to be? And I'll never forget this guy, Italian, about that big and about same way, wide, and he had a white hat on and smoked a big cigar. And he said, what kind of a job do you want, the boy? And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, I want to be a hairdresser. He said, oh, hey, kid, them people are kind of funny, don't you think so? I said, nah, don't worry about it, I know. Now, I got to clarify why I want to be a hairdresser so you don't get funny ideas. I went to beauty school in 1940 for 30 days because I went to a dance one night at a big Aragon ballroom, and I saw, Mike, where you been? He said, hey, I'm going to dress designing school. He said, man, we got girls coming out of our ears. I said, maybe I should join too. He said, no. He said, you go to the hairdresser school because they got 102 girls to two guys. Now, you know, even a blind chicken will get a kernel of corn once in a while. So I went back in 41 and 42 before I went to the Army. And I got 90 days and I didn't learn nothing. And when I went to work for 20th Century Fox is where they sent me, and I had to learn all over again. And you know, my father always said that whatever you do in life is going to take constant repetition and practice. And if you want to become something good, you've got to serve an apprenticeship. Now, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked about serving an apprenticeship in Cleveland and Akron area. I don't know what they did out here. But it was a five-year apprenticeship, and then the work begins, you know. And I find that out more and more today because people don't last too much past five because the honeymoon is over. There was an article in one of our newspapers. I wanted to bring some down, and I forgot. About the honeymoon, when the broom wears off the bush, you know. And suddenly you become comfortable, and then suddenly you drift away from meetings, and the next thing you know, they're out there drinking. And my father said that 6 years when you're on your own, and you got to be better. So I started practicing and practicing that. Long before I knew about AA, I did it on Stardust Hair for Nothing, so I could learn to do my practice my profession. And then one day they said to me, okay, Don, she said, you're going to start working on movie stars. Now you give a little dago like me good money and nice clothes I can buy, and I've got my name on the screens as Hairstyles by Don Cassini. And suddenly what happens, that ego comes in. And I'll tell you, an Italian can get an ego, let me tell you. Right along there. See, she's laughing over here. She knows. And you know, I bought myself a 39 Buick Roadmaster with the wheels on the fenders, you know, fender wells. And I would cruise down Santa Monica Boulevard or Sunset Boulevard, and I'd get in front of maybe swing bar there, and I see these girls, and I have all the windows rolled up, made it look like I had air conditioning, you know. And I didn't have hotter than hell, but I was acting the part, you know. And I start getting not drinking yet. And then one day I'm going to meet a guy from New York City that was out of my outfit, and we're going to go to Billy Berg's, and we're standing on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, and it was warm, and they had no air conditioning in the bars at that time. And the King Cole Trio was playing on this bar, and it was very unique. The bar went around, and the bartender stood in the middle, and the band was there, and the bar turned around like a merry-go-round. And man, I saw these two girls walk in, and they looked good. They smelled good, and they had white dresses on with beautiful tans, and I followed them in. Didn't wait for Hank no more. Got sat down next to him, and I was going to order a Coca-Cola. And then they said to the girl, he said to the girl, what would you like to drink? And they said, well, give me this kind of a drink. I don't know what it was. And I said, well, he said, what would you like? And I was going to say Coke. And I figured, well, if I say, give me what they've got, I can start a conversation. So I said, give me what they got. And I got a drink, and it was a lady's drink in all probability. It was a tall glass. And, you know, I took that first drink with impunity. And it never ceases to amaze me. I hear some kids from these podiums, and they took a drink at 3 years old, and they chased that elusive feeling from then on. I drank wine when I was young. I didn't have no feelings, but I drank that drink, and I felt different. And my book says we take that drink to get comfortable. It sets us off. We sort of feel relaxed, and we blend in with the rest of the world. I don't know nothing about I had a bad child. I didn't have a bad childhood. I played in the fields. I hopped trains. I stole coal off of boxcars to heat the house up in the winter. I had a good time. I never felt inferior to nobody, because if they were superior to me, I'd do something to make them know that I was part of the game. Always getting in trouble, you know. And so I don't know anything about these other hole in the stomach. I don't know nothing about that. And for years, I drank comfortably. I drank comfortably. I worked there 3 years in the studio, and one day the same guys that got me into the studios We're going to set up a sting operation, and I had to get the movie stars to be sung. See, because paybacks are a bitch. And I didn't realize what the outcome was going to be, and when it was all over with, they set up the thing, and you saw the movie Sting with Paul Newman, that was it. When it's set up totally to the T, and they've won all his money, you set him for the big kill, and you tell him, now this is it. And when you get through, you get all the money you can get in cash, and you come down there, and you will make sure you got the horses that are going to win. And sure enough, they won, and when it was all over with, somebody yelled something about being crooks and thieves we were, and they start firing these guns, and you know, the guns didn't have bullets in them. They had the pellets that they moved on the stage in the studios, you know. And you put pellets in your mouth, and you bite it, and the blood would come down. And I told these movie stars, you guys better go to Lake Tahoe and get out of town, because you're accessory to murders. They went to Lake Tahoe, and I jumped the train from the Central Station down there near Alvaro Street in Los Angeles at midnight and came back to Cleveland. And when I got to Cleveland, I didn't like Cleveland because I had authority, my mother and father. So I went on to New York City, and over in New York City, I had an uncle who owned the Tavern on the Green, the Piccadilly Circus Bar, and the Theater Bar and Grill. And he was a member of that funny outfit, too, the Mafia. And I said to him, I can't get a job. My license are not worth nothing here. He said, I'll see what we can do. So he said, then one day he said to me, if you don't find a job, I'm going to call your father and tell him to go back home. To call you back home. I said, no, don't tell my father I'm drinking, because he told me I was drinking like a crumb bum. And I didn't know what a crumb bum was, but he said that. And he didn't know what an alcoholic was, so he said crumb bum. So I finally went to work for Helena Rubinstein on ocean-going liners. And I during the course of that time, and this is something we don't hear about devaluating, our morals and our values. And I think our morals and our values are the things that bother us the most when we start to drink. I think our conscience steps in and plays a big part, and Sister Ignatia was a great believer in conscience. Because your conscience dictates whether you reward yourself for doing something good or you punish yourself for doing something bad. And as I got on board those cruise ships, there was a lot of married women traveling without their husbands because the war had ended and they were having a tough time adjusting to their life. And had their husbands known there had been some sneaky little dago working behind that chair, no, he would have never sent them. But you know, a hairdresser is like a psychologist. I don't know if you ever read the books on that. Because we hear all of the things that are happening. And then I started having a problem because I was fooling around with married women. And I said, you know, I figured, well, that's adultery. I don't want to do that. That's against my conscience. So I found out that if I drink a little in the morning and drink something to go to bed, my conscience is clear. And then as alcoholics we are, we talk about rationalization. Now I could rationalize why I was there and not having a problem with God was because I was single and they were committing adultery and not me. So then I could rationalize that, well, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. There was nobody from Collinwood, that Italian neighbor that was on that ship. And the more I said these things, the more guiltier I felt. And the more I drank. And I started to drink in a pattern every 2.5 hours. I would drink 2.5 to 4 ounces of vodka. And I would drink that way, and I maintained the whole cruise time. And I can tell you this. Someone mentioned compulsion and obsession. I think we've got this thing to understand that the compulsion starts once we've taken the first drink. The obsession is in the mind, and once we take that drink and we're past the obsession, the compulsion sets in. And there's a fellow from North Carolina. His Bert, maybe someone knows him. He's a Jamaican. He lived in Canada for a while. He's a man working down in South Africa. He went down there to find a cure to revaluate malaria because the first one has worn itself out. And he talks about being a chemist, how he understands and how it breaks down the alcohol. I'll send him a tape of that, Charlie, so if anyone wants it, he'll have it. But you see, the compulsion starts once the first drink is set on. If we turn the thermostat there, it's going to give us call for heat. We're going to get heat. And once you take that drink down into your system, it calls for more alcohol because the process of that going through the liver defines the fact that when you cross that invisible line. And we don't hear about invisible lines today anymore. And I think the reason we don't hear about it is because most people don't get to the invisible line. The invisible line is when you can't hate drinking, you love drinking, and you can't stop drinking. You don't want to live and you don't want to die because your conscience is bothering you. And you know, we go through that stage, and I went through that stage, and I came back to Cleveland in 1949 because I got in trouble in England, I got in trouble in France, and it was all because of my mouth and my cocky attitude. Then when I got in trouble in Italy, I knew they didn't like me because I was Italian. Now that's something to think about. I came home, December 1949. Now I think every real alcoholic knows, long before they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a problem with their drinking. And because of our pride and our ego, we refuse to admit that there's a problem with the drinking, but we're going to find a way to slow down a little bit. And I decided I'd come back home and my mother would help me because I knew I was drinking too much. And when I got to Cleveland, my mother was there and she couldn't stop me. So I was going to go back to California, not realizing I had 10 years hanging over my head if I went back and got caught. So I talked to another guy and he said, there's a guy starting a beauty salon and he's been around a long time and he's going to open up some big ones. Go see if you can get a job with him. So I got the job with him. And for 2 years, we were rolling high. Man, we were doing TV shows and everything. My mother couldn't help me. I was drinking every day, working every single day, functioning, and was young and I could shake everything off. And now I would have to drink to go do a TV show and I'd have to get downtown. And well, longer after that, I had a 59 caddy. That's the head of the story. But while I'm talking about TV shows, I did 176 weeks of TV, Make Up and Live with Cassini. And I drank through the whole thing. Everything came out live at that time. It wasn't taped. And I had a drink to get downtown, and we had a bottle law. So I cleaned out the windshield washer bottle in a 59 caddy that I had. Filled that up with vodka, and my wife had a bag that hung in the bathroom with a long hose. I didn't know what it was for, but I cut the hose off of that thing. And I ran it through the firewalls, hooked it up underneath the dash. And when I'm driving down the boulevard to get down to a TV station, if the mental obsession or the compulsion set in to drink and you get that clammy sweat, you get stomach cramps, you stick the hose in your mouth and you hit the windshield washer button, the blades will go back and forth and you get two hot shots of vodka. And if you see a guy going down Pine Tree or one of these drives out here and he's got a hose in his mouth and he's grinning, follow him because he heard my story. Don't let him get away. He's coming back, you know. And that's what I was reduced to, but you know, I kept on doing these things. And in 1952, a bartender said to me, you're drinking too much, Doc. Yeah, I said, well, I said, you know something, I'm kind of cutting down. I said, I'm going to do something about it. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Augie. You see that Italian girl across the street, the model in England Fetzer? I'm going to go over there and I'm going to court her like she's never been courted. And when I'm through, I'll marry her. And he said, if that works, I want to know because I can send a lot of guys out to get married. So, you know, when a drunk goes and take a hostage, and I didn't know about hostages until I come to AA, but I courted this Italian girl like every girl should be courted. I got a daughter, you know, she's a winner. They don't make too many like her. But, you know, she married the one guy who was a nice guy, and she decided he wasn't so nice. He didn't know how to court her. He didn't know nothing. So she went out and divorced him with two children, and she married a guy with a long beard, overalls, and didn't shave and didn't bathe too much. She was going to cure him. She was going to help him. Never been courted and nothing, you know. So it's her problem now. It's not mine. She lives in Florida, far away, and I don't have to see her problems. But, you know, I treated my girls nice. I treated them with respect. And, you know, we were married, and she married me because I was exciting. And then 14 months later, after we opened our first beauty salon, she wanted a divorce because the excitement was killing her. And I said, why? You've got everything you want. You've got a home. You've got a new Cadillac. She said, I don't want that. I want a husband. And she said, you come home every night, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, you know why? I'm out soliciting business. She said, bullshit. She said, you're a drunk. And I said, if I'm a drunk, you made me a drunk. Have you ever heard that one, you guys? She said, no, I never poured a drink down your throat. So we got divorced. I paid her a cash settlement, and that was the end of that. And then I start going now, my mother's taking me to faith healers, you know. And, you know, those faith healers will probably do a good job. But, you know, I went to Catherine Coleman in Pittsburgh, and then I went to Rex Humbart in Akron, Ohio, and then that one didn't work. I was dipped a couple of times, and then they took me to a guy, Ernest Angley, I don't know if you get him here, he's got a bad wig on his head, you know. And he was just starting out in the front room there, and he bopped me on the head, and nothing happened. This program will not work if you don't want it. You cannot get Alcoholics Anonymous by osmosis. You know, I could sit in the chicken coop for 6 months and I'll never lay an egg. But I'm in the environment of it, you know. I'm in the environment, you know. But you know, we come to some thoughts that we're going to save the world. If Alcoholics Anonymous was the panacea for everything, and I'm beginning to think they think so, we're not going to have any churches no more because they will take over. We'll cure everything. You got it, we got a cure for it. We have one cure, and that's for Alcoholics Anonymous, for alcohol, the singleness of purpose. And I know nothing about that stuff, so then my mother takes me to Keeley Cure. I don't know if you ever heard of the Keeley Cure. That's where you drink. It's an inversion theory. They had it in Buffalo, New York. It didn't work because on the sixth day, I was no longer going to get a pill to puke, and I drank when I went home. See, so that didn't work. And then in 1953, my uncle came into my house, and he said, "Kid, you're drinking too much." And I say, "Uncle Tommy, I know what you were like when before the war started. If you're a holy roller now, that's fine. Don't tell me your crap." And he said, "If you ever want help with your drinking, you let me know." And he walked away from me. And I know you may think it's cruel today. My Uncle Tommy came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1941. And when Alcoholics Anonymous was a jewel, I don't know how long AA's been here in Georgia, but it's been a while. But can you imagine when we have them blinding snowstorms if you come from Cleveland, and these men would drive from Cleveland to Akron in 36 and 37 in cars with no heaters to protect something that they thought was a jewel. And the jewel has been passed around to so many of us, it's starting to look like a cubic zirconia diamond, you know. The jewel is no longer bright and shiny because we're destroying it along the way, I think. But he wouldn't tell me about AA because AA was a jewel and they fought for their sobriety. I got a piece of paper in my pocket someplace, I had it. Some of the first men that were in AA, and I knew at least 25 or 30 of them. I was counting that picture out there. There's 14 of the first 100 men that I knew. But you know, I didn't listen to my uncle, and I continued on my way. Now I know the problem is I married an Italian, and they're not nice. So I figured, well, you go looking for a new wife. Now, what would you want in a wife that understands alcohol? What nationality do you think is the best? You probably don't have them down here, but Irish, you know. They drink if it's raining, if it's snowing, the shade goes up, the shade comes down. They drink if the streetcar goes by the house, if the streetcar stops by the house. They drink for anything, wakes, weddings, funerals, even bar mitzvahs if they were invited. And I figured I'd find this Irish girl, and she worked for me. She was a pretty girl. She was the Clairol model at that time. If you maybe remember back when Clairol had just come out, she was the redheaded, pretty young model. And I courted her like God. And man, I'd take her home at 10:30 and I'd say, "Honey, you get ready to go to work tomorrow." And I'd go out and finish off the drunk, you know. So one day she accepted the fact that we were getting married and I was starting to get sicker and sicker. And I'm drinking every single day. But I had now started to build, I had three beauty salons when I married her. Big ones that employed all 20 people in each one. And then I went to meet my father-in-law after I ran away and got married because inwardly I knew I didn't deserve that woman. I think every one of us know that we're not that nice on the inside. I did, anyhow. I speak for me. I wasn't that nice. And I'm going to tell you something today. This may offend some people, but nice people don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You heard that Al-Anon talk about that nice guy she married to. You know, think about it. He was a peach. I see him in Louisville a lot, you know. He was a nice guy. Nice people don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. If we stay here long enough, we become nice. If we put a program into our life, we become better. But nice people just don't come here because I tell you, if you're nice, why would you want to take an inventory? Think about it. Maybe this will give you reason to go back and not think you belong here. Why would you want to make amends if you're nice? You don't have to make amends because you didn't do nothing wrong. And man, I'll tell you something. I could rationalize a lot of stuff. So I married that Irish girl and went to meet my father-in-law. And when I went down, he was a mile and a half away from my beauty salon, and I didn't want to meet him. So I finally went there on Thanksgiving to go meet him. And I'm mad at him because they served me turkey on Thanksgiving, and Italians should have spaghetti or raviolis or something like that, you know. And I go there, and he's there drinking, and I'm pouring vodka in a water glass. And he said, "Kid, if you continue to drink like that, you're going to lose your wife." You're going to lose your beauty salons. You're going to lose everything. And if you ever want to help with your drinking, because I said I wasn't that bad, he said, if you ever want to help, you call me. And you know what I did, the smart little dago. I said, let me tell you something. Why don't you go to Colorado and see my own Uncle Tommy, and you can start your own Holy Roller group. And he said to me, well, I will. And I didn't realize how small A was at that time, because I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. But my father-in-law came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939, December of 39. He worked in New Jersey, went to New York, got sober, and came to Cleveland in 1941 to work at a power plant they were building. He was an electrical engineer. Never told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I don't know, if you don't put this thing into your hand and put it like a jewel and value it, you're not going to hang on to it. It's going to get like a hot piece of coal and it'll just bounce out of your hand one day. Because there are rules in Alcoholics Anonymous that have to be followed. And when I came, I didn't want to follow nothing. I was a man with beauty salons, doing TV shows. How could I be an alcoholic? I drank a lot, but it was because of my business. I was trying to promote business. And the guys don't get their hair done, you know that. But anyhow, it was just going on, and we were married. And my father-in-law put something in my head, and January 1st, 1956, I quit drinking cold turkey. January the 3rd, I had convulsions and VTs. They called the doctor over. Doctor came over to the house. That's when they still made house calls. And he said to my wife, he's a hopeless alcoholic. Leave him lay on that bathroom floor, throw a towel, blanket over him. And if he comes to and he starts moaning, just give him a shot every couple of hours. And if he sees things on the wall and stuff like that, just pick off the bugs. Tell him I'm cleaning them off. So I was seeing a lot of bugs. I had trains in the backyard. I would call a real estate guy while he brought the trains. I'd sneak away from my wife. And then finally I told my wife, you know that statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary? Bring it in the bathroom here. I want to cut her hair because it's not even. So my wife did what the doctor said. She brought that bust of the Blessed Virgin Mary there, and I commenced to cut hair. No scissors in my hand, you know, but I was just effilating. And, you know, she did. And then finally one night I snuck away. And I called the police. And I said, you know what, my house is surrounded with the mafia from California when I was involved in that sting operation. And I gave all the names. They converged upon my city, like you've seen. I think they said they came with SWAT teams to her house. We didn't have SWAT teams then. But they came in all the three different municipalities. Came in surrounding my house. Now they thought they had something. And when they got there, the only thing they found on that floor was this little drunk. And our doors were never locked at that time, and I knew most of the policemen. And the chief came in that night and said to my wife, who called the police about the mafia being here? And my wife said, what mafia? She said, why do you think we're all out here? She said, oh, he said, that drunken bum got off the floor and didn't know what the hell he was doing. And they walked away, the biggest bust of their life they'd have probably ever had. And there was no one there. On the seventh day, I was taken to Ingleside Hospital for the mentally insane, strapped down, screaming all the way in, fed formaldehyde, and slept for 7 or 8 hours. And when I come to, they had loosened up the strap somewhat. I start complaining and screaming. I didn't belong there. They got the wrong guy there. And then they continued to feed me formaldehyde for 7 days. Now, if you never drank formaldehyde, you're missing a treat. We've got that is a treat, because you'll sleep for 7, 8 hours. It puts you out. You don't know what's going on. No one comes near your room because it stinks so much from that formaldehyde. And today they have softer ways. They got Prozac and Valium deficiency, all these new pills to make it easy. You can just float into sobriety. Some of them are floating in and floating out, right over the top. But you know, that was the way they treated us then. And then one day she said, join therapy. And I said, what are you doing in therapy? She said, you sing songs. Not like today, we have co-ed therapy, where I come from. We used to have them. We don't have no more treatment centers. But they go there and they have dances and these new ones nowadays, and people fall in love, and you can't tell them that that's not real love. They're so much in love, because he said, that third step, if we take that prayer together, and the next thing you know, they're tiptoeing off into the woods, and the counselor gets beat off and he wants to break them up, but don't split them up if you see only two of them doing that. Because if you split the two, you then got four, and then four, eight, pretty soon the whole treatment center's infected with that treatment, see? So leave them be, don't break them up. But I went up to sing. And the guy said, the more songs you sing, the quicker you get out of here. So I requested songs from World War I, World War II, and you get your gun over there. And I got out of there. And they gave me a big bottle of Milltown, the wonder drug, in 1956. And he said, take one of these every 4 hours. And I thought maybe four every 1 hour would be better. And I went and I did that for 3 days, and I didn't like pills. I never understood what people see in pills. I liked alcohol because you take one more drink and you got level. And level spelled frontwards and backwards is the same. But when you take a pill, I used to go down. Zoom, I'd be goofy, sitting at a railroad crossing, and I'd be rocking and sleeping. And all of a sudden the train wheels would be going by me. There was no guardrails at that time. And pretty soon the whole car was shaking because I was goofy. And I got home and I called the psychiatrist. I said, do you think I can have a glass of wine with my spaghetti tonight? And he said, well, he said, you haven't had nothing to drink for maybe 10, 11 days. One glass won't hurt you. And I want to tell you, one glass did not hurt me that night. But it started me on a drunk that lasted until August 1961. And during that time, something must have went right. I had 3 children born of that marriage. Don't ever remember them being born. Built a total of 8 beauty salons in a school downtown Cleveland. Right in Playhouse Square District. And I was making money as fast as you could get it. And I was not happy. See, money doesn't buy happiness. And I'll tell you that because I went through it. And it continued on. And now I'm starting to puke in the morning. And sometimes I get diarrhea. And sometimes you have to sit down or kneel down. And you don't know which way to go. And you make a split decision. And most times you're wrong. And then your wife has to clean that mess up, and the love starts to fly out the window, you know. And the 3 children, I'm sorry to tell you, I've never fed them a bottle. I never changed a diaper. I never did nothing. Because alcohol became my lord and my master. I didn't know it was. And if someone would say something to me, you know what the theme song of Alcoholics Anonymous is? If I ever get that bad, I'll quit. If I ever get that bad, I'll quit. And we could always find someone lower than us. And I'm doing everything wrong. I sought lower companions. I found girls in the bars that understood me. And I would say, boy, if my wife would listen to me like you do, I'd never leave the house. And she'd say, boy, if my husband listened like you do, I'd never leave either. And the next thing you know, the conscience kicks in. I got to drink more. And I don't think any of you guys did it here because you look like a nicer bunch of people than I was. I used to write all these telephone numbers in code and then forget what the hell the code was, you know. And you try dialing some of those numbers sometimes. And it just got so bad, puking every morning, diarrhea. Working every single day with Sensen, I don't think they have that anymore, or Bianca, and you put all that stuff on, and aftershave lotion, and then you get in the beauty shop, and sometimes you'd have a good smelling spray net and spray up on the suits, you know. Get rid of that smell and work every single day and did all them weeks of television. And you know, that's alcohol maintenance. Because I still maintain every 2.5 to 3 hours, 2.5 to 4.5 ounces of vodka. And I drank that way until August 31st, 1961. In 1958, I got in some very serious trouble in Las Vegas. And the only check I was allowed to sign was a federal withholding check. And when you got 125 people working for you or better, you got a lot of cash in that thing. And I had an account that was a little bit shady, and I tell them, don't send it in on a quarter when it's due. Wait till the half. So we build up a little nest egg in case we have a bad snowstorm. And I had to use a federal withholding tax check of $15,000 to get out of Las Vegas. And when I came back, the guy that left me there alone, I hated his guts. He was an Italian. See, Italians do not resent. I didn't know what resentment was until I come to AA. We go straight to hate, and if hate isn't bad enough, we go to vendettas. Get them. That's our motto. Get even. You know, I think now, and I just happen to think, is how many times I stuck ice picks in people's tires to get even, you know. Just to get even. You know, if they said something I didn't like, get even. And you know, I'm sorry for a lot of stuff I did. But you know, it got so bad that one day in July, this guy came across the parking lot. And this is the guy that left me in Vegas. He was a road builder. He built Interstate 90 from the other side of Cleveland there all the way into New York City. And he was a wealthy young man, but I hated him. And he came into that beauty shop on a Saturday morning. He said, Doc, come on, I want to buy you a drink. And by that time, my first drink was about 5:30 at home. And 8 o'clock, I needed one. I took a little nip in the back of the beauty shop, but by the time he got there, I needed another drink. And we went to a bar, and he told me a story. And I said, Ted, if you've been talking to my wife, I'll kill you. And he said, no, I haven't been talking to your wife. The reason you haven't seen me from Vegas is when I came home, I was in all kind of trouble with the IRS. And then I knew he was talking to my wife. He said, and I had to get sober, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first time I ever heard that word. And he said, why don't you, I said, what makes you think I could be an alcoholic? He said, if you walk like a duck, you quack like a duck, you might be a duck. So I said, okay. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, come to a meeting tonight. I said, well, she don't want to come. He said, how do you know? She don't want to come. He said, well, my wife called her and she said she'd love to come. See, they're sneaky. And anyhow, he said, bring your own car. Now, I'm not going to leave my car anywhere because I got that vodka in the windshield washer bottle. And I went to that first meeting. He said, there's three doors in the back. If you don't like it, just get up and leave because you're not chained here. And I said, that's all right. I got my own car. So halfway through the lead, I got up and left and went out to the car, started the motor, put the hose in my mouth, got a couple hot shots of vodka, went back to the meeting, sat down. Now she's building birdhouses out there, and the birds are chirping, and she's sober, and everything is so lovey-dovey, and I go, bullshit. And finally, the guy said, the meeting was over, and they were having coffee and cookies, you know. And at that time, everybody was dressed up in a suit at the meetings and that. And my guy come up to me, sober now, had been sober 60 years. He said, hey, Doc, he said, I understand you're not happy here. I said, hey, look at that woman I'm married to, that alcoholic. Oh, he said, don't worry about her. Keep coming back. She'll get better. That was the first lie anybody ever told me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been over 38 years. And now the first time I've talked to her, seriously, was the last couple of weeks because I've got a son here in Atlanta that's in very serious shape. And so I had to tell her and I wanted to thank her for things she did. But you know, she never got any better. And when I come out of Rosary Hall, I was taken in there that next, on August 31st, I went to a doctor and I was totally blown up. Overnight I blew up. And I got yellow and purple and my eyes were jaundiced and my stomach was out to here and I couldn't put shoes on. And I called the same doctor that told me I was a hopeless alcoholic. And he went to his office that day at 1:30. He said, you got to go to the hospital. You got liver trouble. Bad. Now, you don't want to believe doctors. A couple more drinks, this thing would settle out. And he said, no, you got to go. And he said, I'm going out to fill a prescription next door. He said, when you come back, I want an answer. And when he came back, he said, what are you going to do? I said, I got a sponsor. Now, you know where I heard that? When I was calling Seeding Towels and Florida Tiles. And he said, call your sponsor and have him take you to his hospital. And I thought he might have owned one of those little hospitals. Now you got satellite hospitals in Cleveland. A couple doctors, you know, and a couple rooms. And there we had them then. And I called his house, and his wife said, I told her the doctor wants me to call Ted. And she said, well, he's working out. I'll give me the phone number. And she said, I'll have him call the doctor. Now, everything now is coincidental. This story is now at the Vatican because they're starting to commence to beautify Sister Ignatia. If you want to read a great book about Alcoholics Anonymous, how it began with the nun in the first hospital, this biography of Sister Ignatia's life, it's worth reading. I didn't write it, so you can read it. You know, I'm not making any money. But anyhow, it started in it. And it was just, he took me in. And when I got to that hospital, he drove from. Now, God had to be working his life. We had no cell phones. It was ship to shore radio. And he was putting the off ramp in Dunkirk, New York. Now, when we leave Cleveland to get past Dunkirk, it takes us 2.5 hours on the interstate. And today, that's what it takes. At that time, it took him almost 6.5 hours on old Route 20 to come to Cleveland. Now, somebody said during the course of the things here about when we're sponsoring somebody, we're charged with their life. And we better give them the best we've got. I don't know which one of the speakers said it. We better give them the best we got because we're killing people in Alcoholics Anonymous today by not telling them the truth. And Sister Ignatia was adamant about that. Adamant about that. And she taught us right from the beginning, when you got in there, someone took your clothes off and that, But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyhow, I was brought in there, and he was on a ship-to-shore radio. Had the ship been out in Lake Erie another mile, we'd have never got the call. Or if he'd have been another mile into where they were cutting the roads through, he'd have never got the call. And they got the call through. The doctor talked to him. He said, I'll call Sister Ignatia. And he told Sister Ignatia what the doctor said, how bad off I was, that I wouldn't make a week. And Sister Ignatia said, bring him in. My sponsor drove 5 hours to get me to Rosary Hall at 11:15 at night. And as I laid in that bed, and Sister Ignatia walked into the room, because she knew a drunk could die at any given hour of the day. And she believed that that hospital must be open for drunks. She believed that from the beginning in St. Thomas when she snuck him into the flower room. And when I walked into that bed, and I was laying on that bed, and they came in to look at me, and the guy said, he's dying. Sister Ignatia Kidd, and she said, young man, you drank too much, too often, too long, and if you make the night, it's a miracle. And she called Father Winchester, and some of you may have read some old books, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, a pastor. He talked about Father Winchester was the priest, and he came in and gave me last rites. And with that, I went into a coma. And I was tapped 5 times and took out 7 gallons of water. And the pain was terrific, and I was in that coma. And when I came out of that coma after 8 days, I signed a power of attorney. I gave my wife everything I owned because they knew I was going to die. And then started the procession of people daily at 3 o'clock. The Giants of Alcoholics Anonymous were lined that hall. Those were the only counselors we ever had. And they would go down at 3 o'clock to pray the rosary. And every day the rosary was prayed for me. And I didn't think I was going to live. That's why I signed the power of attorney. And then suddenly what happened is they took all the intravenous feedings off of me after about a month. And I was allowed to go downstairs. And they were pushing me down in the wheelchair. And during the course of the time, some of the Giants of Alcoholics Anonymous, Harry Ryan, John Parter, professor in the Paradox, some of these other times that were there, Clarence Snyder, the Brewmeister, my uncle, my father-in-law, they would push me down, and I didn't know how to pray anymore. I forgot the rosary. I forgot the Our Father, Hail Mary. And they would tell me things, and I wasn't listening, because now I hated God. Because I knew my marriage was through, I knew everything was through, and I hated God. So I was down there, and one day Clarence Snyder said to me, kid, he said, this thing is a celebration. And when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you want just not only the cake, you want the frosting on the cake, you want the whipped cream and the cherry on the top. Now, Clarence had a long jaw, and I figured, this ain't goddamn Andy Gump. What's he telling me that crap for? I don't even like cake, you know. And I walked on, and then there was a guy that said, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You never go back to social drinking. Now, I thought he was a giant and brilliant guy because he had a 6th grade education. He came out of Kingsbury Run. 13 guys went in drinking. They drank that radiator stuff out of the radiator, and 12 of them died, and he walked out. And I thought he was smart, so I believed him. And then we started down every day. And finally, on October something, I forget the date, she came up to my room, Sister Ignatia. I was still in a secondary intensive care unit. And she said, I'm going to allow you to leave here because you only were allowed one time in the hospitals at that time. One time through, no more. And in her book, she talks about she didn't believe in repeated admissions to the hospital because it makes it too damn easy to get sober. She didn't believe in federal funding because President Kennedy offered her many times, many, many money. Anthony Calabrese, the head of health welfare, offered her money. And if you read the book, you find that one of the bishops from Boston, the Archbishop, I forget his name, said that she would have been the second Mother Teresa had the Bishop of Cleveland, Ohio, allowed her to go to accept all these honors that were bestowed upon her. And she was the one who tried to help me. And I finally one day was wheeled there, and she said, young man, she said, I would like you to go home and finish off your drunk because your attitude stinks. I really don't think they do that in hospitals today. I really don't. And she said, but if you come back again and you go out of here now and finish off that drunk, you come back and I'll let you come to Rosary Hall because you never were down there more than 20 minutes. And she said, tell me in the morning. As she turned around and she's walking to the door, I said, I'll show you, you little penguin. And she said, what'd you say? I said, I'll talk to you in the morning, sister. And with that, I went down to Rosary Hall never to take a drink again. I left that hospital weighing 114 pounds. No clothes fit me. My wife was on her way to Florida. She had sold all the beauty salons. You see, that was a long time in planning. And I was broke and nothing. So I hate God. I'm going to meetings. I'm not doing nothing. One guy heard a story. He got his wife back in 10 years on his anniversary. I followed him around. I listened to the qualifications. And today I hear people say they don't want to hear qualifications. Well, what do you identify with? Want me to tell you my family are beautiful? The kids are tiptoeing through the gardens? I got nothing wrong in my life? Nah. The qualifications are what kept me coming back. And that was the purpose when AA started. You qualify so someone could identify with you. And I just didn't want to hear nothing. And they took me to meetings. My sponsor come off the road. And then my co-sponsor committed suicide. His father's picture's in that one on the wall there, Judge McDermott. And blues, because his periods of sobriety were shorter than his periods of drinking. And I don't believe people commit suicide when they're drunk. I do it when they stop drinking and they've got nothing to fill that void, and out there's the real world, and reality is something an alcoholic can't stand. We can't stand reality. And you know, he committed suicide because he had a big Ford dealership truck making money, but he couldn't stand the reality. He couldn't stay sober and he couldn't keep drinking, getting drunk. And he blew his brains out. Then my sponsor went back to drinking, never ever regained sobriety again. So about Christmas time that year in 1961, I'm going up to the corner and screw AA. This program is for bums, it's not for people like me. I'm a bigger bum than all of them. I got nothing now. And I went to buy booze up to a bar. As I'm walking into a bar, a guy seen me at an AA meeting. He stopped. He said, "Come on, Doc, I want to talk to you." And we sat down at Kenny King's restaurant, and Kenny King was a man that came in AA, and he died in 71 with 30 years of sobriety. And we sat in the restaurant and talked, and he took me home and sat with me all through the night. And I didn't drink. That man that night saved my life. And 31 years ago or so, that man's son walked into the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm his sponsor today, and he's here with me today, Michael. You see, what goes around comes around. You give it to someone today and it's going to come back to you twofold. That's AA math. And you know, Michael's sober, but I continued the fight. And finally, my sponsor was a big guy, weighed at 340 at that time. And he's sober now, 49 years. And not too long ago, he was near death. And the family called me in because that's what a sponsor, we were that close. And they said, "What do you want us to do with Tony? We've decided we want to pull all things off of him, the ventilators and that. And we don't want him, he don't want to stay on the ventilators. We know that. But you tell me what you used to talk about." And every night that we'd be out together. And I didn't want to be on a ventilator. And I knew he didn't want to be on a ventilator. And it was the toughest thing I had to say, that he don't want to be on the ventilator. And I walked out of there crying because I knew that would be the last time I would see my sponsor alive. And the next day I went back and I walked into that room. And my sponsor was sitting up on the bed eating. And I said to Tony, "What the hell happened to you?" He looked over at me, and he was never a nice guy. He said, "I'll show you. I'll bury you a little bit." And you know, he's home today, and Monday I'm picking him up to take him to the first meeting since he's been in and out of the hospital. You see, I think there's a power in this room, and there's a power in every room. God is in this room, but I don't know about God doing this for people. God is not a cosmic bellboy. I don't know if you're aware of it. There are people at this moment being given the gift of sobriety, and they're turning it down. I don't know if God is the answer, and I'll tell you why I don't know. I'm a Catholic, and if prayer was the answer, why do we have Catholic priests in AA? They pray better than I ever could pray, you know. God comes in, and there's a moment that comes into our life of clarity that God gives to us. And there's a moment someone in Skid Row in Atlanta, where we had Marietta, he's got that moment of clarity now, and he's not acting on it. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. And you could get all the grace you want from God. If you don't take an action, nothing is going to work. I hear people saying, I'm willing. Well, willingness without action is a fantasy. These steps were written to be taken. And you know, I got stuff. I'm one of the guys that bought Dr. Bob's home. And we got a lot of history there. And I thank the God who put this archives together. You have a beautiful display out there. And you know, the history is ours, if we look at it. And when they came to Alcoholics Anonymous from the Oxford group and all the other groups, they took those steps, the third step. They did it on their knees at the house there in Akron, or T.W. Williams' home when it moved out of Dr. Bob's home. And then they immediately started an inventory. So my sponsor took me to Gethsemane, a Trappist monastery. And there was a priest there by the name of Father John Doe, better known as Father Ralph Fall, who wrote the Golden Books and Sobriety Without End. And I hate to give the taper a plug, but he's got the cassettes there and maybe the Golden Books, but he has them. Who was one of the most brilliant men I have ever met, and this is only my opinion. He knew more about Alcoholics Anonymous, he knew about the spiritual side, and can put it into the way that the average layman could understand it. And he looked at me when he brought me there. We drove all night. We had no interstates at that time. And I got to Gethsemane and Trappist Monastery in Kentucky. And he looked at me and he said, kid, I don't think you're happy here. And I said, how could you be happy? You wouldn't be happy. God took everything away from me. And he looked at me and said, kid, let me tell you something. God never took nothing away from you. You gave it away. You sacrificed everything you had on the altar of alcohol. You sacrificed your wife, your children, the beauty salons, and everything. Then I knew my sponsor told him about me. And he said, were you powerless? I said, kind of. He said, did you ever hear of a power greater than yourself? And I said, yeah, I heard them talking sometimes. There's a tree or a light bulb. He said, well, if you were God, would you want a dog urinating? Do you want to use it as a tree? And I said, no. He said, was you powerless? Were you helpless? Absolutely helpless. My life was totally unmanageable. He said, that's step one. I can't. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I said, hold the fort. I got papers at home to prove I'm sane. He said, that's not what I'm talking about. He said, I'm talking about going back to take a drink now, after you've been sober for over a year, and think it's going to be different. He said, that's insanity. Step two is he can. Step for three, we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to a power greater than ourselves, as we understood him. It's understood, not understand, with the faith of a child. With the faith of a child. You know, in the faith of a mustard seed, as Sister Ignatius used to say. And you know that faith of a child, you ever seen a child sit up on a table and the mother or father comes by and he's maybe a year, 6, 7 months old and he's standing up there and he's wobbling and he'll jump into the parents' arms and that's God to him. That's a power greater than himself. Or if you see him running down the driveway and they fall down and skin their knees and they start crying and the mother picks them up and kisses their knees, they stop crying. That's a power greater than themselves as they understood it. And we start to find and search for that power, but that power is not lost. He's been here all the time. God has never been lost. God has never been lost. And then he said that fourth step, he said after A, B, and C, being convinced, we immediately go into, at once, we go into a four-step inventory. Now it's possible that those first 100 men, maybe there were 40 that wrote it, that's the exact amount it was probably, that they knew nothing about it because they said at once we proceed into the fourth step inventory. And since the advent of treatment centers, and I'm sure there's a counselor here that's going to debate me on this, but that's okay, I'll listen. We had everybody taking inventories when they were there at the treatment center. It doesn't mean it has to be perfect, but get rid of some of the garbage. Because when you walk in with 2 bushels of garbage, you want to hang on to it for 6 months? And I hear people try and say that you're not ready to take an inventory. Why aren't they ready? They've been patted, oh honey, you're doing good. Just don't drink and go to meetings. My dog was sober 15 years before he died. Never drank and didn't go to meetings either. But I firmly believe when they wrote that book, they said at once, We proceed into the four-step inventory to find the cause of our problem. And I found that alcohol was never my problem. I was at that monastery and I did exactly what he told me. And I did that Friday night, and Saturday I said, I've got it written out. And it didn't have to be the greatest inventory in the world. It's just what I thought was so bad that bothered me, because he said, take out the worst stuff you have and put it down on paper. And then he said, when I saw him that morning, I said, I finished it to the best of my ability. He said, that's enough. He said, and your sponsor will help you bring more out. And he said, step five, you give it to God for forgiveness, you give it to yourself for understanding, and you give it to another human being for humility. I didn't have that kind of humility to tell it to another guy that I didn't like. So I went and told it to a monk, and they were not allowed to talk at that time. They weren't allowed to read newspapers, nothing, you know, no television, no radio. And I told him everything, and he just looked there, you know, and I heard this guy used to go over the hill and get drunk. And I told, and then I even told him some things that never happened, just to see if he would make a different face, you know. And nothing moved him. But I will tell you this, I emptied everything out I had to empty out at that time, and I felt a little better. 7 years later, I came to Rosary Hall, and that monk had left the monastery. He was an alcoholic. He joined AA, and he became the spiritual director of Rosary Hall. See, it says in the book, we go to a clergyman or somebody else, but today everybody's taking everybody else's inventory, and that's great if you believe in it. I just don't want to hear anybody's inventory, because they may have something they've done that I don't like, and I don't want to lose them as a friend, because I'm not that perfect yet. You know, I'm not that perfect. And step six and seven, he says, you stop doing the things you like to do in step six. And I was young when I came to AA and had black hair. I knew about everything. And seven, we start doing the things we don't want to do. And during the course of my life, you can rest assured I must have done something right to stand up here for this length of time. And it was not always easy. I've had major heart attacks. I've had open heart surgery. I had gallbladder attacks. And I never saw my children until 1973. Didn't know where they were at. Nothing. So if you haven't got your children, don't cry too much because you gave them away. That's what I did. My wife took them away from me. And I thank her now because I realize I could never handle them. And when they came back in 1973, they called and said, your kids are coming off the plane. They're yours. Take care of them. I'll see you. Don't call me. I'll call you. So I took them boys off that plane, and one boy was, I think, about 15 years old. He had paranoid schizophrenia, and I didn't know nothing about it. Came off that plane totally wild, like an animal. My daughter came off, and when she left here, she was being breastfed. And my son came off, the one here in Atlanta. He's younger than my boy by 1 year, year and a half. And I had to take those children in. I was married by then again. I married a girl in AA. I was back in the beauty business again. And I was doing well. And then started around every year until 1988. That boy was in a mental institution. And you know the thing that's sad about his disease is that he can't cure it himself. And if you're bemoaning the fact that I don't think it's happening here at these conferences, you people paid to get here. You're not like the ones that are coming here with these papers. Sign this. Put it right here. You are the best physician you've got. You're the only one that can cure your disease. My son would come to seven meetings a day if he could get cured. So all those years in that hospital, and it would take a toll on my wife, and it took a toll on me, and because of the members of AA stuck by me, and my wife was getting nervouser, and after 1980-something, she took a pill because her nerves were bothering her. And from that pill came the paregoric, and from the paregoric came the booze, and from the booze came the wine, and she died within a year and a half, never again sobriety again. I can tell you about both sides. I could be an Al-Anon, you know, and I could understand the depths of despair that these women go through. Because I really never beat my wife, but what I did to them verbally and the things I did by being away from home. But the last wife I had, I loved her, the one that died. But after 9 years of sobriety, why couldn't I tell her something that would make her want to stay sober? I'll tell you why, because I'm not God. I don't think a doctor is God. I don't think psychiatrists are God. I don't think our counselors are God. They get sober in God's time. People get sober in God's time. When that moment of clarity comes, and if we don't act upon it, we're not going to make it. And one day there's no handle on that door that you can grab onto. And then what do you do then? And I hear people say, well, I'll kill myself. Sure, that's easy. It's not hard. Or I'll go live on the streets. Well, I'm going to tell you something. It's difficult to live on the streets. It takes guts to live on the streets. It's not the easiest way out. Sometimes death is easier. But you know, it's so much easier to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and be welcomed here and just have to follow the rules. There are rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the rules we learn are the rules that we're allowed to pass on to someone else. There's a pamphlet that said if God had spoken to the alcoholic, he didn't give this to the learned man, he didn't give it to the psychiatrist, he didn't give it to the doctor, he didn't give it to the lawyers, didn't give it to the priest, he gave it to two drunks. Because they understood our problem. And I believe that today. And you know, I don't know how the treatment centers are here in this city, but we have no more treatment centers in Cleveland. And I tell you, if you can't get someone in a treatment center, they don't have no Blue Cross or whatever card, the cards they get today, just send them out. They're drunk, and if they can't stand getting sober on their own, punch a cop, because when you come out of jail, you'll be sober. Not hard. You'll be sober. And then if you want it, there may be a sponsor willing to help you. Be in charge with people's lives, and it means we tell them the truth. And sometimes you tell your best friend the truth, you may lose your friend. But at least you can go to bed at night and know that you've told the truth, according to what I know. I've sponsored a lot of people. I sponsored a lot of people. A lot are sober, a lot are drunk, but I had nothing to do with it. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous must be an attraction. Coming to a conference is an attraction. I don't know if you people know, but you people are fortunate down here through the South and Virginia and Carolinas. You've got a lot of conferences. In Cleveland, the city, we're almost the birthplace of AA. We don't have a conference. Why we don't, I'll never know. But you know, I know that this thing works. You know, it's been so good to me. I got my kids back, and my boy got, in 1988, they came out with a wonder drug. And they said, if I sign the papers, if my boy went back to being an animal, then it was my fault. And they said, if he gets better, fine. And I didn't want to sign those papers. And for 20-some years, I was talking about trusting God. I want each and every one of you in this room today, I believe each and every one of you believe in God. But how many of you trust God? There's a difference between believing and trust, you know? And trust comes to earned. It's earned by believing in God and doing things that you trust Him with your life. And we always can say, I can turn my life over to the care of God. When something happens, we change, you know. We change. And I had to sign those papers. And the priest told me, hey, Don, he says, you've been talking about trusting God in all these years. Put your money where your mouth is. I signed those papers, and I tell you, today that boy is doing well. As well as you can be expected. For completing only 13-year-olds at school, he's not where he should be, but God has let me live long enough that I could take care of him. And he's doing better. My boy here in Atlanta, they really don't know what's wrong with him. I don't know. He's worried. I'm worried. But you know, all I can do is turn it over. There's nothing I can do. You know, and I think some of the times I was talking to somebody, I think when you lose a son or you lose a daughter, that's got to be the most devastating thing in your life, because we all expect to go first. And you know, my two boys have been, one was always good, the other one was a problem with the mental occasions. But you know, if I had to do my life all over again, I'd take the same role, because if we all threw our crosses in the middle of the ring, we'd pick up our own cross today, because it fits our back better. And if we put this program into the life the way it was supposed to be put into our life, following the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, life will get better. You know, I know, and you know, there's another thing I know, that I see changes, and I see, you know, I sometimes go to a conference, I go to a meeting, and someone starts, "Who's father?" I yell, "Jeopardy!" I want them to know. And you want to say the prayer? We say, we pray the prayer our father taught us. Not whose father. How about the ones who are out there, go out here and they go out and get drunk? What happened to God? Didn't he watch them? He watches everyone. He gives you the opportunity to do good, or gives you the opportunity to do bad. He gives you the opportunity to run your own life. Free will is what we've got. So in closing, I want to just tell you this, that I'm glad I'm here. I think I thank the people that invited me. But I just want to say this. There's a pamphlet called The Member's Eye View. And it's a conference-approved pamphlet. And the last paragraph, it talks about, from the Gospel of Matthew, John the Baptist is languishing in Herod's prison. And he said, go out and find my cousin Jesus and see if he's the Messiah. And if you find him, tell him I want to get out of prison. So as they walk through Jerusalem or walking along the river, there's God talking in parables to three or four people. And they ask him, he said, you tell John only what you'll see and what you'll hear in the next hour or so. And you tell him the good news at that time, which was the gospel, is still being carried through Jerusalem, through the longest day and the darkest night. So as they start along this path along the river, there's a man laying on the crib, and Jesus said to him, pick up your crib and drag yourself into the river. And when you walk out, you will walk out and you will not be lame. So the man took the crib and walked into the river, dragged it into the river. When he came out, he walked out without being... And you know why he walked? The lameness was gone because he took an action. Action is the magic word in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he came to the blind man. He said, go into the river and rub your mud on your eyes. And when you come out, you'll see after you wash the mud off. And the man went into the river and put mud on his eyes. And when he came out, he saw. And again, he took the action. And then he came to the lepers. And the lepers are a terrible sight if you've ever seen them. I was at Molokai in Hawaii. Went to a leper colony. And they have an AA meeting there. And they're all bandaged up. And when you go in, you put gauze on your face. And you put gloves on and everything. And you know they have one thing in common with the people who love Alcoholics Anonymous. Their eyes are shining. They know that they don't have long to live. And when I think about them lepers, when he tells them to walk into the river with the skin falling off, it must have burnt them. But they walked in. And when they came out, they were all grateful they were cleansed. But there's another thing that's a correlation there. The same as in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're all grateful we're sober. But only one came back to help Jesus, and he had gratitude. And I tell you tonight, if you'd ask me what I've seen in almost 38 years, I've seen the lame walk, I've seen the blind see, and I've seen the sick get well. And through the longest day and the darkest night, I've seen the good news of Alcoholics Anonymous still being carried, one drunk to another. And I'll close with this, so the events that you didn't hear this one. There's a little boy living out in the farm country, you know, a little small city on the road, out in the country. And the circus is coming to town, and the boy hears about it, and he asks the mother for a quarter to go to the circus. And the kid gets that quarter, and he runs, and the mother knows the circus is starting at 2 o'clock. And he heads down the road, the path, and he gets to the town, and the elephants are going through, and the band is playing, and the trapeze artists are swinging from the top of the trails, trucks that they're bringing them into the big tent down the road. And everybody's there, and the boy's watching all of this, and he watches that whole parade go by into the tent. And he's up at the end, and the end, the clown comes by, and he said, Mister, who do I pay for seeing the circus? And the man said, you tipped his hat, and he said, you can pay me, son. And the kid took the quarter, dropped it into the hat, ran home and told his mother. He said, Mom, he said, I saw the circus. And the mother looks at the clock, it's 2:15. And she said, Johnny, she said, next year when the circus comes into town, go into the big tent. I invite all of you to come into the big tent of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.